Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Our officers deserve to be protected and they don't deserve to be shot at by a guy for hours with an unlimited supply of weapons and an unlimited supply of bullets.
Another burst of gun violence, this time in Philadelphia. But is Congress any closer to some meaningful action? I asked Scott Jennings, a close confidant of the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Then,
when someone tells you you're not welcome, then how should integration work?
Amid sometimes violent reactions to migrants in Germany, TV host Jafar Abdul Karim seeks to conquer prejudice in Europe and the Middle East.
Purpose of your visit?
I'm going to see Bruce Springsteen's hometown.
I can't think of a better reason to visit the United States than to see the home of the boss.
And another cross-cultural spotlight, Blinded by the Light, the unlikely bond between a young Pakistani in 80s Britain and America's poet laureate of the working class. Hari Srinivasan talks to the writer and director behind this new film.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. A tense standoff in Philadelphia was the latest national spurt of gun violence as a gunman with seemingly bottomless supply of ammunition pinned down police for almost 8 hours last night. Six officers were wounded in the shootout and miraculously no one died. The past month in America has been racked by gun violence. There are tantalizing snippets, though, now of political conversations and feelers sent out for solutions. President Trump is on record saying that he wants enhanced background checks. But still, there's no definitive commitment to take action. To understand why, listen to this pas de deux of what looks like political dysfunction from White House Counselor Kellyanne Conway and the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
You know full well who passes the laws in this country, Congress, but they're on their six-week recess. Why did they leave in the first place? All this grandstanding, call us back, call us back. They're welcome to come back if they like, but will they?
You're not calling people back in early for to address this gun legislation.
Well, if we did that, we'd just have people scoring points and nothing would happen.
But the chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus, Representative Karen Bass, told me earlier that's entirely disingenuous. There is legislation ready for the Senate to take up if it wants to.
I do have to emphasize the House has already passed legislation. We passed legislation on backgrounds, and we also passed legislation on some of the loopholes that allows people to get guns. So it's the Senate. The bills are sitting in the Senate.
And so here's a simple question. After more than 250 mass shootings so far this year alone, is there any new movement on gun laws? Scott Jennings is a Republican public relations consultant. He's based in Louisville, Kentucky, which is Mitch McConnell's home turf. And he's an alumnus of McConnell's state campaigns, Senate campaigns. And he's been talking directly with the Senate Majority Leader about how to act on gun safety legislation. Scott Jennings, welcome back to our program.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
So, look, I don't know, but give us the temperature of what's going on right now. It seems that there is a maybe more serious search for solutions than even after Parkland, even after Sandy Hook. Is that right? Are we absorbing the atmosphere correctly?
I think so. I think that we've reached a tipping point in public opinion in the United States on this issue. You know, the Congress did act after Parkland. They did pass some legislation to update the background check system that's already in place called NICS. They appropriated a lot of money for school safety. So there was some action. But none of this, of course, is a panacea for the big kinds of events that we've seen and the ones you've mentioned. And now I think there's a legitimate question going on among the American people, which is, what is wrong with us? And what can we do about it? And I do believe there are serious conversations going on among the people who need to be having them. Most importantly, of course, the President of the United States.
Well, you did see and listen at least to all those snippets of sound bites, which two of them were interviews that I did. One of them was a radio interview with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. So tell me, the New York Times reports that you have been in touch with him, that you're urging him to move on this issue of gun legislation. Can you fill us in with some of your conversations, what you're saying, what he's saying to you?
Well, I don't usually divulge the private communications I have with people who seek my counsel. However, I would say I told him much what I wrote in USA Today and a lot of other American newspapers recently, that people of goodwill can come together here and try to do what we can do. I think the American people understand there's no panacea. There's no magic wand that will make all the evil and the crazy go away out of humanity. But there are things we can try to do to at least address and be responsive to this American question right now of how are we going to try to stop some of these events from happening. I told him I thought background checks was a pretty simple proposition if you could find language that satisfies all the parties. I told him that I thought the red flag laws, where you could give people these avenues to report people that they thought could be a danger to themselves or others, and that seems like it has a little bit of momentum. So I thought some of these ideas were worth bringing up. And I also told him that I thought it was all worth bringing up if the president, Donald Trump, is going to get behind it. Ultimately, he's the key. To pass a law, you've got to get 60 votes in the Senate, the House, of course, and a presidential signature. If President Trump signals that he'll sign a package of something, then that will probably pretty easily bring a package along in the U.S. Senate.
Okay, so here's a little bit of a soundbite from President Trump when he was asked about this week on Tuesday. Let's just listen. We can talk about it.
I am convinced that Mitch wants to do something. I've spoken to Mitch McConnell. He's a good man. He wants to do something. He wants to do it, I think, very strongly. He wants to do background checks, and I do too, and I think a lot of Republicans do.
So kind of there he has it, Scott. I mean, that's what you were saying. Every side has to want it. Well, the House has put forth legislation. The president is now on record there again saying he wants it. And he said that Mitch, as he calls him, Senator McConnell, wants to do it too. What do you think? What did McConnell say to you? Does he?
Well, he wants to have a process that can produce legislation and an outcome and not just grandstanding. I think there are a lot of politicians in this country that love to talk about this issue, but they want to talk down the process. You know, they want to grandstand on when the Senate comes back into session, or they want to attack President Trump for not being serious. Everybody that wants to do something here that's in a position to make it happen is saying the right things. And so what I hear Senator McConnell saying is we need a process that can produce an outcome and not grandstanding. And ultimately, that means, is there a package here that can get 60 votes in the Senate and attract a presidential signature? If Donald Trump signals he'll sign a law, and if there are 60 votes for it, Mitch McConnell has said he's going to bring it up and call for a vote on it. So right now, as I understand it, all the main players are talking, their staff members are talking, and that's a good thing. The Senate should not come back in right now, by the way, because this cake isn't ready to come out of the oven, but it might well be in a couple of weeks. And if it is, the Senate will come into session, and McConnell, as the majority leader, can run a process that can produce an outcome.
So you mean that when the actual recess ends, when it's due to come back, there might be something to come back to and something to come back for?
Absolutely. I think it's going to take a couple of weeks here to figure out what package can come forth that can attract a presidential signature and 60 votes in the Senate. The House has sent over legislation. There's been other legislation considered in the Senate before. But right now, the quest is on to find something that can get to 60 votes and attract Donald Trump's seal of approval. Until then, bringing the Senate into session is kind of a useless exercise, and bringing this up for a vote is useless. McConnell has been very clear in his public statements. He doesn't want a process that ends with grandstanding. He wants a process that produces a result, an actual legislative outcome. McConnell's not much of a grandstander, but he does like to produce things that make results, and it could make a difference. You know, there's a lot of discussion going on right now about would any of these laws actually make a difference in any of these shooting incidents. All that needs to be hashed out before they take it to the floor.
Mm-hmm. You say he's not a grandstander, but he's a bit of a blocker. I mean, we've seen him exercise his power as majority leader. I mean, the biggest block that he did was to prevent President Obama from nominating and bringing to the Senate a Supreme Court nominee. So do you think, from what you're listening to and what you're absorbing now, that the time for blocking on this issue is over?
Yeah, I do. I believe the Republicans need to come up with a series of solutions here that the president can sign that are consistent with our party's values on the Second Amendment and that are responsive to what the American people want to see, which is to do something on this issue of these mass shootings. I mean, speaking as a conservative, I sure as heck trust Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell to do something on the gun issue more than I would say a President Elizabeth Warren and Speaker Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. I mean, let's pretend we go a year in advance and the Democrats win the election. Do conservatives want them making the laws on this issue, or do you want conservative Republicans making the laws now when they can actually take into account the Second Amendment freedoms that we hold dear in this country? So I trust Trump and McConnell. They've worked very effectively together on a number of things. And if they can come together in agreement on something, I have no doubt that McConnell will run a process that can get the president something to his desk that he can actually sign.
I want to ask you about the president, because you mentioned it a lot, because obviously his signature is really important. And he has said certain things. But again, in the reporting, we understand that he's kind of being tugged and pulled by various different concerns of his advisors who are talking about his base and what they might feel and this and that. And even his son, Don Jr., who the president calls his expert numero uno on guns. And it looks like, according to reports anyway, that Don Jr. is not so pro some of this stuff like red flags. The president hasn't talked about addressing the nation yet. He hasn't talked about even wrangling or calling up senators and doing that kind of behind the scenes stuff that presidents do to twist some arms and use the power of the Oval Office. Again, what is your knowledge, and what does your gut say about really where the president is on this and how far he's willing to go?
Well, I think the president has good instincts for public opinion, and I think the American people want something to happen, and therefore that's why you see him publicly saying he wants to do something meaningful. I also think what you just described is exactly why this isn't ready to go to the floor of the Senate just yet. The president is getting briefed, obviously. He's hearing from different senators about their proposals. And I think he's trying to wrap his brain around what can I support that's consistent with my party's values and that is consistent with what the people who support me, what's consistent with their values, but would be responsive to the issue. I just don't think the president has come to a final answer yet on exactly what that package looks like. He's getting lobbied on a number of ideas that have to do with background checks and the red flag laws. But I think the finer details of what a piece of legislation would look like are still, you know, a couple of weeks away as the president continues to get briefings on these matters. So my gut tells me that he knows the American people want something to happen. And now they're going through the sausage making process of actually writing a law that can pass the United States Congress. I'm really hopeful they get there. I think the American people want something. I think there's overwhelming bipartisan support for a couple of these ideas. And it would really show the American people that our government is being responsive to these horrific tragedies if they could come together in a bipartisan fashion and pass something. It'd be a real feather in his cap along the lines of criminal justice reform that he signed into law. I think he'd really enjoy having this accomplishment.
And indeed, I mean, you know, you mentioned the American people. They overwhelmingly want something to happen, including in, as you mentioned earlier, the Republican Party. So it really is not the American people. It's a small group of lobbyists who've been holding this back for so many years, because they are overwhelmingly, over more than 90% of the American people want something done. Let me just play for you, and then I'll get you to respond, what the mayor of Philadelphia has said in the wake of this shooting.
If the state and federal government don't want to stand up to the NRA and some other folks, then let us police ourselves. But they preempt us on all kinds of gun control legislation. Our officers deserve to be protected, and they don't deserve to be shot at by a guy for hours with an unlimited supply of weapons and an unlimited supply of bullets. So it's disgusting, and we got to do something about it.
So, of course, he's a mayor. He doesn't have federal authority in terms of the legislation that we're talking about. But he does speak to certainly Democrats and, as I say, a lot of people around the United States. So where do you think the possibility in this current debate of actually going further than background checks, further than red flags and mental health awareness and prevention, et cetera? What about the assault weapon ban? I know it's not on the table right now, but there was one. It did work. Do you think that that could be reinstated, and wouldn't that be a really great thing?
I don't think the assault weapons ban is going to pass the U.S. Congress, and I don't think the president would sign it into law, mostly because the term assault weapons is kind of a made-up term. I mean, what a lot of people apply that to is semi-automatic weapons, which applies to millions and millions and millions of handguns that are already in the hands, lawfully, by the way, of U.S. citizens. So I think that term and that debate would frankly derail this conversation. Mm-hmm. It strikes me that the most politically possible things at this moment have to do with background checks, red flag laws. I think if you want to look at equipment, the high-capacity drums or the high-capacity magazines, like the one used by the shooter in the Dayton shooting, I think that's a little more possible. But even then, you get into the whole question of banning things and confiscation, which really makes a lot of Americans, especially hunters and those that have weapons already, very, very nervous. So I think if you're looking for an outcome, it strikes me the best way to get an outcome quickly is to really focus on the possible, which strikes me as background checks and red flag laws. I think the high-capacity drums and magazines should be debated. I'm not sure why somebody would need 100 rounds in the bottom of their weapon to get off that many shots the way they did in Dayton in that horrific tragedy. And I personally have said I thought it would be something that would be politically feasible as a matter of public opinion. I'm not sure that it could pass the Congress, though, and I'm not interested in something derailing this whole conversation. I'd like to see something pass that the president can sign into law. And if it doesn't include that, you know, 90% of a loaf would be better than no loaf at all.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we just talked about assault weapons, but I mean, let's just take the one that has been causing the most mayhem in many of the mass shootings, and that's the AR-15, which is basically the civilian version of an M60. I mean, it's a military rifle. And so many, including police unions and all the sort of security experts, are just kind of outraged that that's allowed in private hands, particularly given what damage and what terrible carnage they've created. Do you think even that one, I mean, how does it make you feel in your gut that somebody who's, you know, clearly unhinged can use that kind of weapon, and many of them get them legally?
Well, I think that particular weapon has gotten a lot of attention because of the incidents, but the way it works is not really any different. It's a semi-automatic weapon, not unlike a lot of the handguns that are in use. Most of the murders and violence in the United States, by the way, are using handguns and not these rifles that you're talking about right now. Again, I think when you start banning individual weapons and talking about even confiscation, which is what some of the Democrats are talking about, it makes conservatives who want to be constructive in this process extremely nervous. And I just don't think they're going to go down that road. In the United States, we already banned machine guns and we already banned fully automatic weapons. Those would be, you know, military-style weapons. So those things are already banned. It strikes me if you want to get at the heart of this particular rifle, the high-capacity drums and magazines could be a way to get at that. But again, there's just a lot of nervousness in the Republican Party and among conservatives about banning and confiscating certain kinds of weapons. So to me, I don't want to see this derailed. And if I thought that would derail the idea of background checks and red flag laws, I certainly wouldn't be for it, because I wouldn't want to see the whole thing come apart in September and then nothing happen. I think the American people want something to happen. And so getting a couple of those items that can actually attract enough votes and a presidential signature seems like a good step in the right direction to me.
All right, Scott Jennings, thank you very much indeed. And as you say, half a loaf, perhaps better than no loaf at all for the moment. Now, while gun violence is seen as a uniquely American crisis, a far-right political murder sent shockwaves through Germany earlier this summer. Walter Lübcke, a member of Chancellor Angela Merkel's Conservative Party and a defender of her refugee policy, was fatally shot in the head on his front porch in June by a neo-Nazi extremist. Critics claim that in Germany, as in America, police failed to take right-wing extremists seriously. Jafar Abdul Karim is a German. He is a voice for tolerance and respect in his troubled country. With his award-winning program Shabab Talk, Youth Talk, and his new program Jafar Talk on the Deutsche Welle network, Karim gives young Arabs around the world a platform to break taboos and open minds. And I asked him about his challenging mission, forging connections in a sometimes hostile world. Jafar Abdul Karim, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
So you do something quite unusual. Tell me what kind of bridges you're trying to build at this moment in Germany.
These moments in Germany, there's a lot of the unknown, because 2015, you have a huge number of people coming from Syria, from Iraq, from Afghanistan, arrived to Germany or fled to Germany. Yeah. So people coming, arriving in Germany, the Germans have a lot of questions. Who are these people? What culture do they have? What does their religion say? How do we want to live together? So there's a lot of questions. And since I understand both cultures, I am familiar with the European, with the German culture, but also with the Arab Muslim culture. And that's why I try to bring people together, to let them talk, exchange, know each other more, because there's a lot of prejudices against each other. So when you bring them together, they know each other more to support the dialogue. They don't always have to agree. They often disagree. But at least you have people talking to each other.
So you talk about prejudice, and certainly we've seen this in Germany since the influx of about a million refugees that Angela Merkel allowed in, in a policy of compassion and humanity, really.
True.
But it did have quite a lot of backlash, both personally and politically.
True.
So one of the casualties was this far-right group, AfD.
Yes.
Or Democracy was a casualty because this group got into parliament. We're going to play a clip from one of your shows where you engage with members of the community in Saxony, which is where AfD is very strong.
Yeah, okay.
Here's the clip.
Was stört Sie so am meisten in der Lindenstraße?
Die Wohnverhältnisse und die Mitmenschen einfach auch ringsrum.
Was heißt das?
Naja, ich sag mal so, die ganzen Asylbewerber, die jetzt in die Lindenstraße rein verfrachtet worden sind. Man hätte vielleicht auch die Mitbewohner in dem Haus auch fragen können, ob das für manche in Ordnung ist. Also wenn ich mir bei uns alleine in den ersten zwei Wohnblöcken angucke, leben alleine bestimmt schon 10 Familien.
Und das finden Sie nicht in Ordnung?
Nee, finde ich nicht in Ordnung, weil es genug deutsche Obdachlose gibt. Und meiner Meinung nach sollten die zuerst eine Wohnung bekommen, bevor jemand kommt, der von weiter weg herkommt, eine mag die Vergangenheit sein, wie sie mag, aber trotzdem zählen für mich als erstes die Deutschen und nichts anderes.
Hi. Okay, für Loda?
Ja, ne. Ja, da war es ja, immer war es.
Le?
Scharie, l'aql scharie nafso.
Schon mal netter.
Ja, ne, no, nisbet in Nazini kibire.
Das ist inter Schachsian, aschet Tajribi.
Aschet, aschet, akid. بدي اشوف اذا في شيء بوست طلعت هيك لقيت شفت لحم وهن بيعرفوا انه انا لحم خنزير وهن بيعرفوا انه انا مسلم ما باكل لحم خنزير طلعت هيك رجعتها محلها وسكرت ثاني يوم صارت تطلع منه ريحه قلت شو بدي اعمل يعني شلته حطيته هون.
That's pretty extreme when you see that young Muslim man, you're talking to him and somebody in the community has put pork meat through his letterbox, knowing that that's an insult.
Yes.
Then the girl, the woman who seems fairly, you know, reasonable, but she's like, hang on a second, Germans first, refugees second.
Yes.
How did you feel when you first started engaging these people about this issue?
You know, when I'm talking to her, I'm talking as a reporter. When I talk to her as a reporter, I have to ask the right questions to understand why is she thinking the way she's thinking? Why is she saying German first? Because I told her, according to the Constitution, there's nothing that said German first. Humanity first, the human is first. But she thinks that German goes first. And as a person, when I, you know, when I go back and think, I'm kind of asking what is happening now that we're forgetting about humanity, we're forgetting that people who really need help, who also have war in their countries, need the help of Europe, need the help of Germany today. I'm kind of sad when I hear it, because I know Germany's economy is doing well. I know that the people in Germany are very welcoming. We're seeing part of the people. Well, we don't have to forget the majority in Germany are still welcoming refugees and are being very helpful for refugees, you know. But you have the minority, as we can see in this clip, that people are against them. And then on the other hand, I can see how such words can affect the life of a person fleeing to Germany. Because when someone tells you you're not welcome, then how should integration work? Yeah. When someone tells you you're not accepted, we don't want you to be here, and you're trying to be part of the society, then it's really hard to integrate. It's really hard to say I'm motivated to learn the language, to know the culture. Then you're more busy being neglected. Then you're more busy being, say, they don't want me. Because we have to see what's going on in Europe, in the world, as a whole image. Even when you look at the way the rhetoric President Trump is using, you know, when he was racist against the congresswoman, this is exactly what's giving kind of, I don't care, I wouldn't say inspiration, but that's helping others to say, look, even the president of the United States, the land of liberty, status of liberty, we all see it and have it in mind, is saying such things.
So I want to draw a little bit of a connection between some of the violence in Germany, some of the groups like the Identitarian,
Identitarian movement.
Identitarian movement.
Yes, they also visited.
Yes, there was a political murder. I think it's the first one in living memory. A member of Angela Merkel's party was shot in the head.
Okay, yeah.
You visited a group of people who belong to this identitarian movement.
Yes.
And they have links, or at least the movement has some links with the Christchurch in New Zealand shooter, with the El Paso shooter. They all repeat each other's slogans and kind of draw inspiration from each other. Mm-hmm. And you went to see some of the people who I think identify with them.
Yes.
Right? Let's play this clip.
All right.
Deutschland. Deutschland bleibt.
Was heißt das?
Ja, was heißt das, das, was ich sage? Wenn Sie das nicht verstehen, dann ist das Ihr Problem. Dann haben Sie ein großes Problem.
Eine Lösung wäre Apartheid.
Apartheid?
Ja.
In Deutschland?
Damit meine ich zum Beispiel eine Stadt für Muslime, eine Stadt für Christen und so weiter.
In Deutschland?
Es wäre eine Lösung, ja. Und dann kann man langfristig schauen, welche Stadt sich besser entwickelt.
Haben einen Migrationshintergrund?
Ja, gut. Dann sind sie halt nur deutscher Staatsbürger.
Aber nicht Deutscher und ein Teil der deutschen Gesellschaft und deutsches Volk.
Zum deutschen Volk gehören sie aus meiner persönlichen Perspektive nicht.
Wissen Sie was, wenn es Ihnen hier nicht passt, dann gehen Sie dahin, wo es Ihnen besser passt.
Ich habe hier in Dresden studiert und ich lebe heute in Berlin.
Ja und, dann gehen Sie, wenn es Ihnen nicht passt, dann gehen Sie hin, wo es Ihnen besser passt.
Wo soll ich denn hin?
Ja, ganz einfach. Wo Sie herkommen.
Wo komme ich denn her?
Ja, das müssen Sie doch wissen. Woher soll ich denn das wissen, so ein Quatsch?
Ich habe hier in Dresden studiert und lebe in Berlin.
Hören Sie da auf mit dem Scheiß.
Aber Sie sind nicht Deutsch.
So, I mean, you were shocked there, and you're shocked here as I watch you watching that again.
Yes.
There is a rise in far-right nationalism in Germany, of all places. The Interior Minister says that, you know, there were 24,000 extremists, 100 more than in 2017, and half of those were considered violence-oriented. In other words, it's a real worry. It's not just words.
Yes. It is a real worry. Even the identitarian movement, when I went there, they weren't classified according to the German domestic intelligence service as extremists. But I think weeks ago, they were classified now as extremist movement. When you talk to them, they have so much hate in what they say, and they have so much thinking of race that they could do anything. And that's why you feel like, how far will all this go?
Do you yourself feel in danger? Do you feel threatened? I mean, you go and you confront these people and talk about them. You have a show. You're very public.
I believe in the job I'm doing as a journalist. I believe in freedom of speech and freedom of expression. So if someone tells me I'm not allowed to go to a place because he or she thinks I'm not allowed, then I'm going. Because the constitution in Germany allows me to have the same rights as everyone, every other citizen. And that's why I see it as my job, as my responsibility to go there and talk to the people. When I'm there, I'm rejected. When I'm there, people don't want to talk to me. But that's exactly what I have to do. Because on one side, it's important to be the voice for others. Because a lot of migrants in Germany today might not have the possibility, might not have the function as a reporter, as a journalist, to go and talk to people. But I can be the voice of people who today are maybe afraid or feel insecure or fear no one is talking in their name. So I go there to confront people, to ask and to tell them I am part of it. And it's important to stay, you know, you saw it. I was like calm. I was listening. I was trying to understand. I was trying to know why are you thinking the way you're thinking, and maybe other people can see it, and these people can see it too, that which may lead to a change, you know?
Are you surprised that this kind of white ethno-nationalism, this white supremacy, actually this growing movement in many places, whether it's Russia, whether it's parts of Europe, whether it's the United States, it's now become a thing that law enforcement and analysts and political analysts are really concerned about. Are you surprised that it has spread so far?
I am surprised. I just want to mention something. I just came from Lebanon days ago. And the same rhetoric that we are hearing from the AFD, or we're hearing sometimes also from President Trump and from our other politicians, you have it in Lebanon today against the refugees, Syrian refugees and Palestinian refugees. Like I had a talk show where a politician, a Christian politician, he's part of the Patriotic Free Movement, where he said, we don't want refugees anymore. Lebanon first, Lebanese first. You hear from the AFD also telling Germany first, President Trump, America first. I think there is a kind, if you observe, if you look at the facts, there is kind of something going on. I still don't have the question, the answer for it. But what I can observe or what I can see is there's kind of insecurity of their own identity. There's a kind of a new identity search. Who are we today? And all this is leading to this kind of nationalism.
Yeah.
You try to understand it, but on the other hand, you say, like, how far is it going?
I mean, incredibly, the numbers in Lebanon are just staggering. It's like one in every four people in Lebanon is a refugee, you know, which is huge.
I mean, we have to admit and say Lebanon has a huge challenge when it comes to Syrian refugees. That's for sure. But, you know, there's a red line. There's a line that we don't have to cross. It's about humanity. But what's happening now, politicians are being racist. Politicians are saying things that they shouldn't say.
And that they couldn't say.
And they couldn't say. Yeah. And this all rhetoric, this all discussion is leading to a kind of, I mean, if the politician is saying yes, I can say it too. And if this person is saying too. And that's, you know, the whole speech, the hate speech, the racist speech that's going on. This is affecting on the ground because people are seeing it every day. It's getting very normal. The norms and the standards of respect and tolerance are changing.
Yes. Obviously, your program is on Deutsche Welle, which is the international service.
Yes.
So it's not airing in Germany.
No.
So who is your message directed at?
So my show airs in the Arab countries. Yeah. It's addressed to the Arab people, Arab-speaking people. But you also have Arab-speaking people after 2015 that arrived in Germany. So they are watching the program too. Politicians are talking a lot about refugees. So what we do is we say, let's talk with refugees. So we already had German politicians who are in cabinet or in parliament. We invite them and bring together with refugees and they talk. So, you know, it's all about what you need today is more dialogue, more knowing each other, more speaking.
And you've done something quite unusual as well, because not only have you got this mission.
Yeah.
Bridging the terrible gaps between far right and refugees and migrants. But you're also trying to bring a sort of a more dynamic conversation to the youth in the Arab world
as
well.
Sure.
Because they're also within very strict confines
of
their very conservative, often dictatorial regimes.
Yes.
So I want to get to one of the programs you did in Sudan.
Yes.
Now, it's before the current uprising in Sudan.
True.
So the youth have really taken to the streets. The story's not over, but they've been really battling for their rights against the military regime there.
Yeah.
But here is a cultural and social moment that happens on your show in Sudan.
Yes.
كونه إنه أنا أكون ماشي في الشارع يتعامل معايا زول كأوبجكتيف كجسم ما كبني آدم يديه الحق في إنه يتحرش بي هو المريض ما أنا اللي بلبس ما أنا اللي بلبس أنا لسه أنا بلبسه بيحترم إنسانيته بيخضع لحريتي في الاختيار ما بيخضع للمجتمع بكل عاداته المريضة وبكل التقاليد اللي هو شايله في ظهره عشان هو يفتكر إن هذه شريعة.
So, I mean, that's a completely different issue to what we've just been talking about.
Yes.
Here is a woman railing against these strictures on you know, her freedoms and her ability to wear what she wants.
Yeah.
You've once said that Shabab Talk, your program, is the baby that survived the Arab Spring.
Yes.
What are you trying to say when you go to places like that?
Today, people, young people in the Arab world, they want to live the way they decide for their own. But you have a lot of challenges, traditions, religion, social structure, and political systems that are suppressing the younger generation. So what we say is we want to have a platform. There's a platform where everyone can be who he or she wants to be. They have the right, and again, it's a right, it's a human right, that I can talk, that I can express myself. And that's what we want the people to have. We want them to say, there's a program, there's a platform where we can discuss about everything.
And they are respected. Do you get into trouble, by the way, when you do those things
there? You know it on your own. You get troubles. It's part of our work. Yeah.
Do they try to stop you?
Yes. You have.
Because it's really pushing against the religious, the Islamic extremists.
Sure.
Yeah.
They try to push you. You get threats. They try. But, you know, there's one thing is that when people and fans and people who watch the show are behind you. That's the strength we have today.
Because safety.
Because they want to talk. They want to talk. Like we saw now in Sudan. Also, the same thing happened in Jordan. We went to Mosul. We went to Lebanon. We went to Egypt. We went to different countries to say and to the people have a platform through the program on Deutsche Welle to speak.
Yeah. You obviously are 1,000% integrated. You're a German citizen, but you're a migrant.
Yes.
You went there to yes. seek safety and opportunity.
Yes.
And, you know, it's been said that, you know, you have the narrative of the good migrant.
Yeah.
I mean, is that, first of all, an acceptable term for you? And how did you manage?
I would say you have a lot of examples like me in Germany, but I happen to be on TV. You know, but you have a lot of examples, people working, being part of the society, integrated, you know, there's even a discussion, what does it mean to be integrated? Yeah. And they're working, going their lives like every other citizen or every person living in Germany. When it comes to my own perspective, to my own experience, from day one I arrived in Germany, I didn't wait for anyone to tell me what are my rights. I didn't want for anyone to tell me if I am part of Germany or not. Because I said I am part through work, through hard work, through learning the language. I came and already knew the language. And I don't get affected or influenced when people say go out. The good thing is that you have in Europe, it's the land of law.
The rule of law.
Exactly, the rule of law. Yeah. And when you have rule of law, so the law is on your side when you're also doing the right thing. So enjoy being who you are. Go for it. Just do it. And You'll do your
well,
thing.
Well, you're doing it, and it's an amazing job that you're doing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much,
thank
Jafar
you
Abdul Karim.
Thank you.
Great bridge building there. Now, The Boss meets Bollywood with our two next guests. Acclaimed director Gurinder Chadha, known for her films such as Bend It Like Beckham, has teamed up with journalist Safraz Mansour to tell a deeply personal story. Their film, Blinded by the Light, is based on Mansour's memoir, and it follows a young Pakistani-British teenager in London in the 1980s who finds unlikely salvation in the American icon Bruce Springsteen. It is also an intimate portrait of escapism in the face of racism and the shackles of tradition. They sat down with our Hari Srinivasan to connect the dots and tell him about their fateful encounter with the boss.
Gurinder Chadha, Safraz Mansour, thanks so much for joining us. Safraz, I want to ask, how does a Pakistani kid in the UK get enamored by the boss?
By having a very lucky encounter with a friend, to be honest. I was 16 years old in Luton in 1987. Didn't really know anything about Bruce Springsteen at that point because I was just listening to what was in the charts at that time. And I start college, and this kid, Sikh guy with a turban, he's got his headphones on, he's listening to this music. I say, what are you listening to? And he says, Bruce Springsteen. And that seemed a very unusual choice for someone of that age and that ethnicity. But he just said, Bruce Springsteen is a direct line to all that's true in this world. And he just had such passion that even though I knew nothing about Springsteen, I just thought, maybe I'm missing out. So he gave me some cassettes and I listened to the music and I suddenly thought, oh my God, this guy is connecting with me. He's writing and singing songs directly about my life.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where the fandom started.
Okay, and we've got a clip after you've heard some of his words.
Root! I listened to everything, both tapes. I'm telling you, I can feel it all right here. It's like Bruce knows everything I've ever felt, everything I've ever wanted. I mean, sometimes I feel so weak, I just want to explode. Explode and tear this whole town apart. Take a knife and cut this pain from my heart. I didn't know music could be like that. I mean, is a dream a lie if it don't come true? Or is it something worse?
Congratulations. You popped your Bruce cherry. You never forget your first time.
Gurinder, is that what drew you to it? I mean, did that idea of a scene, this passion, fly off the page when you were starting to read this stuff?
Well, I'd been a big Bruce fan myself, separately from Safraz in London. And I just thought he was masterful with his words. And I didn't know I was going to be a filmmaker then. But to me, everything he was writing seemed very filmic. So that's what drew me to him. And then I read an article that Safraz wrote where he'd interviewed him.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, there's another Asian in the United Kingdom that likes Springsteen. And that's how we connected.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting is at the time, and you bring this out in the film, the music was escapist. I mean, it wanted to drive, especially if you were poor and underclass, and you're like, you were looking out beyond there, and Bruce Springsteen's music is the opposite of that.
Yeah, there was a great line I read afterwards when I started reading up about him that said, most music is about Saturday night, and his music was about Monday to Friday. And everything else I'd listened to, whether it was Madonna or Michael Jackson or Max or Pet Shop Boys, it was all escapism. You know, it was all kind of romanticized and sort of hyper-real. Whereas, as Gurinder says, you know, Bruce is talking about people who work in factories, living in dead-end towns. He's talking about people who don't get on with their dads. And that's not the stuff that pop music normally deals with. And I just thought, well, it's obvious why somebody like myself who came from that kind of background, had a bit of a difficult relationship with my parents.
Yeah.
It's kind of obvious why I would connect with him, even though at the time everyone laughed and said, you know, what's a kid like you liking Bruce?
Yeah.
Also, it was the 80s. And in the early 80s, we'd had a lot of disturbances up and down the country. You know, we were the sons and daughters of the original immigrants to England. Mm-hmm. And we were, in the political landscape, we were all trying to figure out who we were, you know, what our identity was. And were we British? Were we Asian? Were we British Pakistani? Were we British Indian? All this was going on, you know, around us. And plus, it was the time of Margaret Thatcher. And so there was mass unemployment and hardship and poverty. And particularly for young people, a lot of people were leaving school and just going on the dole and had never had a job, like for 10 years. So this was also the backdrop, I think. And so Bruce resonated with that kind of political context.
You guys bring up identity, and race is almost a character in this film. And here we are looking at this, these events that happened 30 years ago in the context of what was happening in the UK. But for a lot of people in the United States right now, it's actually very interesting to watch. And even across Europe, it's interesting to watch that some of these things are cyclical and they're back again. And we thought kind of as a society, well, we've learned from that. We're better now. But maybe we're not.
Well, we have been working on this project for quite a while on the script. And in the meantime, I'd gone off to make Viceroy's House. And after Viceroy's House, I was thinking, right, what am I going to do next? What film do I want to do next? And I was worried about the overlap of Blinded by the Light with Bend It Like Beckham, because it's in an Asian community set. Story. But then Brexit dropped in England. You know, the vote happened. We were like, oh my God, what's happening? And then overnight, suddenly all these xenophobes came out, and there was a lot of sort of tension around race and hate, and people thought it was okay to get on buses and shout abuse at elderly black women who'd worked in our hospitals their whole life. And for me, it was like a complete breakdown in the fabric of society, and especially because it was happening in London, our hometown. It was very distressing.
Yeah.
And that's when I made the decision and said, okay, I'm going to make this film next, and I'm going to show exactly what it was like. And normally I kind of shy away from being too visceral around racism, but in this film I said, no, I really need to make that point. It was his reality, you know, being spat at on the way home from school, the character of Roots in the film. His family regularly had people who would urinate through the letterbox, and all these things. We need to tell these stories now so people understand. And so this film for us became extremely relevant to make today, to kind of stem the tide, really, and show an alternative way of being.
Yeah.
But I also think these divided times that you're talking about, I think that's why the film is kind of connecting with people, because, you know, ultimately it's a very hopeful message it's giving. It's saying that a Pakistani kid in England can be completely turned on by the most American icon there is.
Yeah.
And, you know, in 87, that was completely plausible, that a kid could think that America was a promised land.
Yeah.
Someone who was Pakistani could think that. And I think that that makes people feel good about themselves. And it also suggests to people, you know, an idea of America that maybe doesn't feel quite as close as it was in 87, but is still possible and is still plausible. And I kind of feel like that's also what's sort of hitting a chord.
Absolutely. And we see that. There's a scene that's actually in the trailer. That scene actually happened. And I nearly took it out because I said, this is too corny. No one's ever going to believe this. And we had to put it back in. But the scene, you know, when it plays, you see it with an American audience, with all audiences. They're very uncomfortable at the beginning of that scene because of presence. Events.
Yes.
But at the end, what the guy says is what actually happened to Safraz.
Come to see your visit?
I'm going to see Bruce Springsteen's hometown.
I can't think of a better reason to visit the United States than to see the home of the boss.
And I think it's moments like that that suddenly make people think there is an alternative and there is some kind of hope, you know.
No, there's a scene when you were talking about your character extolling the virtues of the United States, at least in a screening in New York City, there was almost audible laughter. I mean, he was talking about this idyllic place. That
everything that's
welcome.
Good about America, about Britain, is even better in America.
Yeah,
says,
and, yeah, and you know, in a city like New York, you're like, oh my gosh, well, they are hearkening back in their minds. It's like, yeah, you know what, that might have been true and perfect, and maybe we could get back to that more perfect union.
The crowd that you're talking about, they're kind of probably a bit cynical about America, but in a way, outsiders have always been the ones who are the most idealist in a way about America, because they sort of see it in the most purest sense. We were talking earlier, you know, if you're growing up in Luton, the idea of the New Jersey Turnpike sounds incredibly exotic. You know, if you're actually having to do that on your morning commute, maybe not so much.
Right.
You know, so I think that's always been true. But I think it's quite nice to be reminded of that kind of wide-eyed hope in America.
And it's interesting because the film is getting these great responses in America. People are connecting with it. People aren't necessarily seeing race.
Yeah.
They're just seeing the father-son story and the universality of that, which is fantastic to see. Yeah.
You're almost dealing with some of these heavier topics juxtaposed with just a certain joy to this. I mean, it's almost like almost a Bollywood dance number that breaks out in the middle somewhere. You're not hitting people over the head with it. They are heavy ideas, but somehow you've kind of managed to wrap it in this very digestible format.
Well, I think, obviously, having Safraz's story is fantastic, because that's a great way of telling a story about being, you know, connected across oceans, you know, with words. But at the same time, you know, it's a very truthful and a story about racism and coming through that and wish fulfillment.
Yeah.
He had a dream and it came true.
Yeah.
And that's a great premise for a movie. But at the same time, you know, having worked now for as many years as I have, you know, in filmmaking, you know, it's tough. As soon as you want to put a person of color in a movie as a lead, immediately everyone's like, well, that's not going to be commercial. That's not going to work. That's not going to be successful. Yada, yada, yada. Still to this day.
So let's talk a little bit about the music. You've been to 150 plus Bruce Springsteen concerts.
Yeah.
I mean, what makes 149 worth going to? Like, what is new? What is the... What?
Why do it? Well, it's very simple. Say somebody said to you, you know, at 8 o'clock tonight in Madison Square Garden, if you turn up, I can guarantee you for the next 3 hours, you're going to have an indecent amount of pleasure. You're going to feel jubilant. You're going to feel exultant. You're going to be moved. It's going to be profound. You're going to be surrounded by people who are decent, caring people. And you're all going to be just together for those 3 hours, having an amazing time. Do you want to come? What are you going to say?
Exactly.
And so, you know, in the world of filmmaking and music, this is very expensive to get the rights for something like this.
Yeah.
So how do you go about getting Bruce Springsteen on board?
Well,
what do you have, 17 of his songs? Or
19.
19 songs
19.
In here. Wow.
Count them. Well, what happened was a miracle happened, basically. Safraz wrote his memoir. I read it. I said, this is great. I know how to turn this into a great movie.
Yeah.
But it's nothing without Bruce's songs.
Right. Well,
there's no movie without it. And luckily for us, Bruce was coming to London in 2010, and for the premiere of his film, The Promise, I got invited. I took him as my plus one, and we both stood like fans on the red carpet with cameras waiting for Bruce to go by so we could both, like, you know, be in an image with him. And we thought somehow we'd be able to talk to him, but beyond that, I didn't really have a plan. And then as he walked the carpet, we got very, very excited. And because of these 150 shows that he's been to, and of course, he doesn't look like many other Springsteen fans, Springsteen recognized him. And he walked over and said...
He comes right up to me and says, I really loved your book. Out of nowhere. And I had the book with me. I was thinking I was going to give it to him because I didn't even know if he knew it existed.
How you doing?
Been a while.
Good.
The book was really beautiful.
You read it?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
It was really a lovely thing.
How did you know about it?
Oh, people sent me copies.
And you took the time to read it?
Yeah, it was really, really...
Fantastic, man. We should have a chat about that. I want to make a film of it.
Okay.
So while he was having his meltdown with Bruce, I was like, oh my God, this is it. I got to do a movie deal right now. I've got 5 seconds before he's moved on.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, I'm going to be really professional. Think, how are you going to do it? How are you going to say to him, we need your music to make the film, when he notoriously does not give his music, right? We know that. So I just thought, okay, I just have to ask him. And it, I was trying to be professional, but it came out very high-pitched, I'm afraid. Yeah. And I was just like, Bruce, I'm going to Chandler. I'm in London. I know you like this, but thank you so much for liking the book. Please, will you help us? We want to make a film of the book. Will you help us? Will you help us? And he sort of looked at me, and he looked at Zafraz, and he went, sounds good. Talk to John. And behind him was John Landau, his manager. And John came up to us and said, what are you guys talking about? And we said, the book, you liked the book. We want to make a movie. And then we exchanged contact and they, the managers, they said, you know what? He likes the idea. You should you should do it. And that's exactly what we did. We wrote a script that we knew Bruce would like.
Well, we hoped that Bruce would like.
Well, you're right. We hoped. But we were writing it for him. And then word came back and he said, Tracy Nurse, his manager, said he's read it. And I was like, oh, my God, what did he think? What was And she said, he said, I'm all good with this. And I said, and? And she said, no, he just said, I'm all good with this. So I said, what does that mean for the music and everything? And she said, he said, I'm all good with
this. That was it. That's all
you should go and make your freaking movie.
Yeah.
And that's how it all happened.
It's amazing that all he needed to say was, sounds good, and I'm all good with this. And that's what's enabled this entire film.
Does he like it?
Yeah, so this time last year, I came to New York to show him my director's cut. I said, I've got to show you the movie because I want you to have at least some feedback. If you don't like something, I can change it now.
Yeah.
And we sat in a small room, him and his managers, put the movie on. He watched it very intensely. And at the end, there was absolute silence. And I was like,
this could go either way.
Either way. I had no idea. And I knew the managers wouldn't say anything because they wanted to hear what he said. And then I thought, well, I'm going to go to the front. I'm going to put the lights on. I'm going to get my tape and I'm going to get out of the room so they can all discuss it. That's what was going on in my head. And so I stumbled to the front in the darkness, put the light on. I was going to get the tape and I turned around and he walked over to me and he put his arms around me and he gave me a big kiss. And then he said, wow, thank you for looking after me so beautifully. Don't change a thing. And I was like, ugh. He had a blue sweater on. I remember that. I was like, lost in this blue sweater. And then I thought, put yourself together, Corinda. And then we sat down and for an hour he talked about what he loved about the film.
Wow.
All the moments, all the nuances. You know, he loved that there were lots of 80s tracks that weren't him because he loved the fact that they gave the film a great context.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
He loved that Tiffany was in there.
Yeah.
And he turned to John and said, God, that Tiffany, you know, she was like riding so high in the charts when I couldn't even get a song in the charts, you know.
Yeah.
So it was really cool to hear his feelings of 87, actually. Yeah. But he really appreciated the way that the songs, that I'd brought the songs to life in this current context and in this, in the current climate, because they had been, you know, given a new meaning, if you like, you know, with obviously with Javed and his experiences in Luton. I mean, he loved the cultural side because he loved the book, which is why he gave us the permission. Yeah. But in seeing it in reality, I think it was that urgency of seeing his words being transported through a 16-year-old Pakistani kid come to life again in a way that was very relevant to today.
All right, Safras Mansour, Gurinder Chadha, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
What a great story and tribute to Bruce Springsteen that his words have such extraordinary impact in an entirely new and different context. Join us again tomorrow night when we will go to the Horn of Africa, where the population of cheetahs is under severe threat. Fueling this drop, demand in the Arabian Peninsula, where the animals are kept as pets and feature in the social media posts of the uber rich.
People who have a cheetah as a pet are causing the species to go extinct.
It's leading the way towards extinction.
Mr. Bottle is one of the favorite toys that we've found.
American biologist Laurie Marker and her cheetah conservation fund are racing to save the species from extinction.
This is not how a baby cheetah should be living. They need to be living out in the wild.
They've set up this safe house in Somaliland for the rescues. It's bursting at the seams.
Seeing them in here, it breaks my heart.
So for tomorrow, watch more about these rescues. But that's it for now. Remember, you can listen to our podcast anytime. See us online at amanpour.com and follow me on Instagram and Twitter. Thanks for watching and goodbye from London.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.